Там до Перетова, Абрама.
А вот Найда.
Абрама, там до Перетова. А, very nice.
Start your day the term way, Rabbi Asher Oshach.
Last week we discussed how Hetesko works, what Hetesko is and how Hetesko works. Today, Be'ez Hashem, I'd like to discuss a few potential restrictions which come out of, once we understand how Hetesko works, we'll see that there are going to be possible restrictions. A Hetesko is not a one-size-fits-all situation where it resolves all problems, and obviously there are going to be some restrictions. Before we start with the restrictions, I just want to recap briefly the fundamentals that we mentioned last week. We learned last week that the Gdolei HaPoskim, just over 400 years ago, they felt the necessity to implement a takana which would enable a Yid to lend another Yid money and make a profit on it. They came up with the idea of a Heta Iska. So we saw last week that Heta Iska is made up of five main parts. What are the five main parts? So the first part, which is really the main part, is the restructuring the loan into an investment. Instead of a lender, firstly, the Gdolei HaPoskim, they were misaken it. They were misaken it specifically for situations where a borrower needed the money to invest, for investment purposes only. He needed it either to invest in his business or to make an independent investment. That's what he needed the money for. So the idea of a Heta Iska was that instead of the lender lending the borrower money with interest, which is asa, and the borrower would use the money for his investment, instead the idea of a Heta Iska was to restructure this loan into an investment, that instead of the lender giving the money as a loan, he would give it as capital to the borrower to invest on both of their behalf. Once it's an investment which is investing on both of their behalf, so the lender now becomes a partner together with the borrower, and he's entitled to a profit. This is what enables the borrower to pay the lender a profit on his money. So when we say investment, there are two kinds of investments used in a Heta Iska. There's an investment of a Kulei Pikadon and an investment of a Chatzi Mil v'Chatzi Pikadon. A Kulei Pikadon investment is a standard investment which is very common nowadays as well. This is where Negeiat Heta Iska, where a lender would give money to a borrower and he'd tell him, I'm giving you, let's say, £100,000. The £100,000 I want you to invest entirely for me. The investment will belong to me, I'll be entitled to all the profits, and I'll have to bear all the losses. This is a Kulei Pikadon investment. The lender will pay the borrower a fee for sourcing the investment, managing the investment. This is a Kulei Pikadon investment. The Chatzi Mil v'Chatzi Pikadon investment is when the lender creates a partnership with the borrower. It's not that he wants to remain the entire owner of the investment. He wants to create a partnership. So if we also work with £100,000, he tells the borrower, I'm giving £100,000. I want you to buy an investment. Half of the investment, the £50,000, should be my share of the investment. I want you to invest for me. And the other £50,000, I'm lending you the £50,000 for you to buy yourself the other half of the investment. This way, the lender creates a partnership with the borrower. The lender and the borrower are now joint owners of this investment. And they're both entitled to half of the profits. And they both have to bear also half of the losses. This is a Chatzi Mil v'Chatzi Pikadon. So the Heta Iska usually uses a Chatzi Mil v'Chatzi Pikadon investment. Sometimes Kulei Pikadon, but usually it's a Chatzi Mil v'Chatzi Pikadon. So there's three points we have to remember to keep in mind to understand the continuation of the Shei, is that the three points with a Chatzi Mil v'Chatzi Pikadon. Firstly, the joint owners of the investment, which means that they're both equally entitled to only half of the investment each, half of the profits each, and they also have to bear half the losses each. And number two is that because the lender is lending the borrower money, so the borrower has to repay this loan, come what may, whether the investment is successful or not successful, the borrower has to repay this loan. And thirdly, because there is a loan that's taking place, due to the loan, there's a relationship of lender-borrower between these two people, so the borrower is not allowed to benefit the lender any more than the lender is entitled to. So really, strictly speaking, the lender and borrower are really an investor and an investing manager, an investment agent. But to keep things simple, we're going to refer to them as a lender and a borrower all the way through. This is stage one in Heta Iska. Stage two is this is the Skat Hircha, that the borrower, when he's now working on the lender's on this investment, so he's working half on his own half of the investment, and he's also working half on the lender's half of the investment. So to work on his own, we understand he's working on his own because that's the way he's making his profit. But to work on the lender's half of the investment, that is a problem of ribis. He's borrowed money, and in exchange for that, he's now benefiting the lender more than what he's entitled to. The lender's not entitled to have somebody working for him for free. So the way to get around this is by paying him a fee, a schar tircha. So we saw last week that the schar tircha is either you can pay him a minimal fee of a pound, or you can pay him an extra percentage of the profits. Instead of taking 50% profits each, the lender will now take 49% profits for himself, and 51% profits will be giving to the borrower. An extra 1% for his fee in working on the investment. This is stage 2 of the investment. Stage 3 of the investment, this is where the lender must be guaranteed his capital. The idea of the Hetiska was that a lender can lend that money and be guaranteed that he's going to receive his capital back. So with the Hetiska, we explained last week that a Hetiska cannot guarantee the lender's capital back, because an investment, by definition, has risks. If a lender would try and guarantee his capital, if he would tell the borrower, I'm giving you this £100,000, I want you to invest it, but I also want you to guarantee me the capital, it means I want you to repay to me whatever happens, then really what he's doing is he's giving him an investment, and he's saying, I'm giving this investment but with terms of a loan. Just like a loan, you have to repay me whatever happens, I want you also to repay me this investment. An investment with terms of a loan, Chazal considered it is a loan. So what a lender would be doing, if he'd be guaranteeing his capital, is he'd be changing the investment back into a loan, and then he wouldn't be entitled to any profits. So how does a Hetiska guarantee a lender his capital? So this is based on a swara of the Trumas Hadeshen, which remember Ben Avigdor, he adapts this swara of the Trumas Hadeshen, who says that when a lender lends money or gives money to invest to a borrower to invest, so he's not entitled, if he doesn't have to believe the borrower when the borrower says that he's invested the money and it wasn't successful. He needs sufficient proof. He doesn't have to believe whatever the borrower tells him. So he's allowed to put down conditions which make it difficult for the borrower to prove that there were losses. And as long as the borrower can't prove that there were losses, then the borrower will have to reimburse him. So the Rebbe Ben Avigdor, he said, based on the Trumas Hadeshen, that when the lender gives the borrower capital, he should stipulate with him that I'm giving you the money to invest, and there's a condition that I'll need proof of 2 kosher edim to verify that there were losses. And as long as you can't verify that there were losses with a capital, then I won't believe you, and by default you have to reimburse me in my capital. This is, in a nutshell, how a lender guarantees, or how a Hetiska, more or less, it doesn't guarantee, but makes it very likely that a lender will be repaid his capital. But there is an element of risk in every Hetiska, which is what a person needs to know when he's writing Hetiska, that if there were losses, and the borrower can verify with 2 kosher edim, then he will not have to repay the lender his money. This is stage 3 in a Hetiska. Stage 4 in a Hetiska is guaranteeing the lender a profit. A lender also, when he's lending out money, he also wants to make a profit on it. So how do we guarantee a lender profit? As we just said, that Hetiska is an investment, is a system of making investments. An investment, by definition, has risk, and it's not always going to generate a profit. So how does a lender guarantee himself a profit? So remember Ben Avigdor, he wanted to extend the svara that we just mentioned from the Trumas Hadeshen and say that just like a lender can make a condition, can stipulate with the borrower that if you're going to claim that there were losses, you're going to have to verify it with 2 edim. So at first, Rebbe Ben Avigdor wanted to say the same with profits. He wanted to say that if you're going to claim, or not if you're going to claim, whenever you come to declare the profits, you're going to come and tell me how much the profits were, I don't have to believe you, I'll need sufficient proof, and I want profits of 2 kosher edim. On that, the Poskim disagreed with Rebbe Ben Avigdor, and the Samar wrote him a letter and told him that it's too much to demand to verify profits for 2 kosher edim. And instead, what you can do is, which Rebbe Ben Avigdor said, that instead of verifying profits with 2 kosher edim, profit will have to be verified with a shavua. The idea of demanding a shavua is, remembering the reasons, is that a borrower most likely will not want to make a shavua. A shavua has severe consequences, which we saw last week. There's a medrash that Chazal bring down, Shulchan Aruch, the Torah Shulchan Aruch bring down a medrash which says that Yana HaMelech, he owned 1,000 ayaris, and they were all destroyed because people of the cities weren't nizar, weren't cautious in making even a shavua's emes. So remember, he reasoned that if a lender stipulates with the borrower that he's going to have to verify profits with a shavua, he'll most likely prefer not to make a shavua, and he'd rather pay profits even if there were no profits. This is more or less the way a Hetiska also guarantees or makes it likely that a lender will receive a profit as well. Stage number 5 in a Hetiska is the last stage, is the sum is pashus. This is the lender's interest rate, if you will. It's not really interest because the Hetiska there is no interest, but it's the profit that a lender is allowed to make to keep things simple, we'll call it the interest rate. So how much is the lender, how much is the lender's interest rate? How much can a lender demand the borrower to pay? So we explained from Moshe Feinstein and the Bris Yehuda brings down also from the Sma and the Minchas Pitim. He says that the Sumis Pashus, the lender's interest rate, could be the expected profit that this particular investment is expected to generate. For example, if the money was given to invest was £100,000, and it was given to invest, and the expected return of this investment would be, let's say, £20,000, so the lender can now tell the borrower that this, I've given you money to invest, I'm anticipating a return of 20%. So either you pay me 20% and no questions asked, you pay me 20%. If there's any extras, you keep the extras. If there's less, you top it up. You pay me the 20%, which I'm anticipating. If you don't want to, then you have to make a shvur. You have to verify the profits with a shvur. The choice is entirely in the hands of the borrower, or entirely up to him. A borrower will usually choose to ask the lender to forgo on his right to a shvur, and he'd rather pay this anticipated share of the anticipated profit. So we also added that with the chatzim mevuchas bekodem, the person has to keep in mind that with the chatzim mevuchas bekodem, the lender is only entitled to half of the profit. So even if the investment is anticipated to bring in a return of 20%, with the chatzim mevuchas bekodem, he's only entitled to 10%. So if he's only entitled to 10%, so the interest rate which he is allowed to set down would only be 10%. This is stage 5 in Het Eske. We'll discuss later if a lender is ever allowed to demand more than this amount. So start with the potential restrictions. Number one, what would be if a lender would want to borrow if a borrower would want to borrow money for personal use? Do you want to borrow money either to repay a debt or to make a chasna? Would you have a heta to use a heta iska to borrow money to repay a debt? So according to what we've learned, there shouldn't be any room for this. The heta iska is designed to restructure the loan into an investment. If the borrower is not borrowing money to invest, then you should have no heta to pay a profit. And indeed, that's what the Azoi state in Chochmah Sodom, Sma, Shulchan Aruch, Rav, Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, they all seem to hold clearly that there would be no heta for a borrower to borrow money with a heta iska, and if he's not intending to invest it. However, there are three tremendous kedushim in some of the Achronim, which sometimes would allow a borrower to use a heta iska even for personal use. Kedush number one is the chiddush of the Marsham. Marsham brings down, that he saw in the name of the Buchacha. He says a swara he says that Tachonas Maran, the Tachon of Ramin ben Abigda, was that when a lender gives the borrower capital and uses the heta iska, then he becomes a partner in all of the borrower's other investments. Which means that if the borrower does have other investments, so the lender will automatically become a partner in all of these investments. So says the Marsham, so even if the borrower is not intending to invest the money, but if he's got other investments, he's got other existing investments or any other assets, so the lender will also become a shutter, will become a partner in all these investments, and he's entitled to a share of all the investments which the borrower owns. So if he's got an investment, then he would not have the set of the Marsham. Where exactly the Marsham, the Buchacha, saw this in the Takanos Maram, either it was a Kabbalah from the Takanos Maram, or he was with Akis and some Russian in the Nusach of the Heta Iska. I'm not sure where he saw it. Different Sefer also, he didn't see exactly where the Mashan saw this in the Heta Iska of the Medel ben Avigdor. Chiddush number 2 is the Shoyle Meshe. Shoyle Meshe says, what a tremendous Chiddush. Shoyle Meshe brings down two similar Shailas. One Shaila he was asked is there was a man who had his creditors chasing him. He owed a lot of money to his creditors, and they were all chasing him. And even he'd been taken to court, and the court had ruled in favor of the creditors, and that they would be allowed to, if he's not going to pay out, they'd be allowed to take his house and sell his house. So he didn't know what to do. So he went to approach his son-in-law and asked him, would he be able to give him a loan? Give him a loan and with interest, and he'll be al-pihat iska. He'll borrow the money and pay him back the loan with interest al-pihat iska. Son-in-law agreed, and the father-in-law, he took the money, he paid off his creditors, and everything was fine. Everything was fine until the time came to repay the loan. The son-in-law came to the father-in-law and said, "Can I have the repayment of the loan with the interest?" So the father-in-law said, "I'll repay the loan, but the interest, I can't pay you interest because interest is also." So he says, "I'll pay heta iska." So he said, "You're right, I'll pay heta iska, but the heta iska is only for investments. I didn't invest the money. I told you it was for my creditors. There was no no profit made with the creditors, and therefore I can't pay any interest. The son-in-law, he went to his Rav, and the Rav sent the shine off to the Shulam Meshiv. Shulam Meshiv, he wrote back in the Tshuva, a tremendous chiddush. He sided with the son-in-law and said that the profits of a Heta Iska do not have to be direct profits of the money. Even indirect profits, completely indirect profits of the money, that can also be considered a profit of the money, and the lender would be entitled to a share of those profits. So, even? So that he doesn't speak out, I don't know. Yes, the should be even future investments. As long as it's a profit coming because of this loan, it's indirect profits, and that should be able to be, the lender should be entitled to a share of those profits as well. Even if it wasn't b'shasavol, but at the end of the day, this money is generating a profit, like every investment. When I give money to an investor to invest, at the present moment when I give it to him, it's not yet investing. In the future, he's going to invest, and it's going to generate a profit. I'm entitled to those profits which come out of my money. So it says that. So Shulam Meshiv wrote back to him and said that this father-in-law he gained on three accounts. He gained on account number one. He gained is that if the creditors would have come and taken his house, or before the creditors would have threatened to take his house away, and the son-in-law would have sold his house for cheap, he would have had to make a loss on it. A quick sale is usually going to be less than the value. So that gain in value would be, could be able to be considered a profit. Number two, the second gain Shulam Meshiv said is that had the creditors taken his house, he would have had to rent a property. Those rental payments they would have had to pay can also be considered a profit. And thirdly, he said that if the father-in-law had any other assets, any other investments, he would have had to get rid of in order to repay the creditors. So those investments could be considered instead of the investment which he should have been making. And that would be a third indirect profit which the father-in-law could have made. And therefore, the Shulam Meshiv paskened that the father-in-law has to repay the loan together with the interest. So, an example of such a thing would be if somebody would want to make a chasna, and he would want to remortgage his house to make the chasna, but instead he can take out money with a heta iska. So, l'chayr misvara, he should be able to pay what the money that he would be saving on remortgaging his house. That should be able to be used to pay the lender a share in the profit according to Shulam Meshiv. The Rabbi Asher brings a similar example. He says that if a borrower has a savings account which is accruing interest, and if he'd want to make chasna, he'd have to withdraw this money making interest and lose on the interest, then this interest could also be used for profits to go to a lender. This heta is a controversial heta, and anybody who wants to use it should be asking the Shaila first. But we'll soon see there's a more simple answer. Chiddush number three is that Shulam Meshiv wrote an even bigger chiddush. He had another Shaila. He had a Shaila from a Malamad. A Malamad, he wanted to make a chasna. He was marrying off his son, and he had no assets whatsoever. He had nothing to his name. All he had was his meager salary from being a Malamad, and he wanted to borrow money. He had to iska to marry off his son, and use his monthly salary to pay off the loan with the interest. So he asked Shulam Meshiv, can you do this? So Shulam Meshiv wrote back, he can. Shulam Meshiv extended his chiddush even further. He said that the Malamed has an indirect profit. What's indirect profit? So he said if the Malamed wouldn't be borrowing this money with Heta Iska, what would he be doing? He'd have to take from his own pocket. He'd have to reduce from the food that he eats. He'd have to reduce from his own bread and butter. And if he reduces from his own bread and butter, he won't be fit and able to work. And if he's not fit and able to work, he won't be able to be a Malamed, and he won't be able to earn his salary. So because of this, says Shulam Meshiv, that his salary could be considered a profit which comes indirectly from the money borrowed. He says another gain which the Malamed has is that marrying off his son, he gets a gain as well, that he no longer has to provide for him. The son is living in the house, he has to provide for him. Once the son gets married, he no longer has to provide for him, and that would also be considered a profit which the borrower could give the lender a share of. This is chiddush number three. This is even more controversial. And the most often do not agree with the third one. The second one seems to be a nidden. Some do agree, some don't agree with it. To avoid relying on these chiddushim, there's a very straightforward answer, a very straightforward solution, which one could use. This is an excellent answer. We'll be using it a few times, and that is that if the borrower has any other existing investments or any other assets, then instead of investing the money, he can give the lender a share of any existing investments to the value of the money that he's now borrowing. Instead of taking the money and investing it in an investment, he could use that money and just give a share of any existing investments that he has now. And the lender will now become a partner in his existing investments. That would be a very straightforward answer. And now the the borrower would be able to pay the lender a share of the profit from his existing investments. This eitzah is brought down firstly by the Masas Binyamin. He brings the son of the Masas Binyamin, the back of the of Masas Binyamin. He brings the tshuva down. It seemed like it was very common in those days to borrow money for personal use. And the Masas Binyamin, he was looking for eitzah, and this is the eitzah he came up with. And nowadays, a lot of the poskim they bring this eitzah down. We'll soon see a few extra advantages of using this eitzah. So there is a discussion in the Achronim that if somebody does use this eitzah, then how does the borrower give a share of his existing investments to the lender? So the Sma says that he should be doing a kinyan suda. He has to do a kinyan suda to be makna a share of the existing investments to the lender. Shulchan Aruch says holds it's not necessary because it's only a share of ribus drabonon, so we can rely on kinyan kesef. The easiest way of getting around it is that if it's written in the Heta Iska clearly that the borrower, in exchange for the money, he's being makne, he's giving a share of his existing investments to the lender, then when he gives that shtar over to the lender, that would be as good as a kinyan shtar, and no other kinyan would be necessary. So a common question is would the borrower, if he doesn't have any other existing investment, but he's got his own house, if he's got his own house, could his own house be considered an investment to be able to pay the lender a share of this of the profits? So the calculation would have to be made. If strictly speaking, if nowadays when the house prices are constantly rising, so theoretically it should be allowed, but the person would have to always make the calculations. If the profit being made from a house would be equal to the profit that the lender is demanding from the borrower. For example, if a house is worth £300,000, and if you add up all the profits, if you include the capital gain with the rental gain, let's say it's £30,000 a year. So then on a £300,000 house, £30,000 a year is 10%. So as long as the lender is not demanding more than 10%, or with a chatzim bivu chatzim kodin, he's not demanding more than 5%, then a house would be able to be used for investment for a heta iska. To use anything less than a house is already questionable. Someone to say maybe you can use a car, it's not very lucrative business, there's not so much profits generated from a second-hand car. But there are some who want to rely on it, but also they'll have to make the calculations. First, the value of the car, and also how much profits theoretically could be made from using a car as an investment. What people have to know is that if a borrower does not have any other assets, doesn't have any other investments, then he will not have any heter to use a heter iska to borrow money for personal use. And this shaila is very nagei in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, all the banks have a heter iska. So if a borrower now wants to use his debit card to swipe to pay for his groceries, and he's going to be going into overdraft. So what he's doing is he's borrowing from the bank, and he's spending on his groceries. Where's the investment there? He's got no investment. And if he's got no other assets, then he should have no heta to do this. He should not have heta to use an overdraft facility. And Reb Pinchas Vin said he asked Reb Yashiv of the Shaila, that he said if somebody's got no other assets and he wants to use an overdraft facility to pay for his groceries, has he got a heta? Reb Yashiv says, I give them all a bracha, they should have other asokim. They should have other assets. But until then, they have no heta. This is restriction number one. Potential restriction number two is very common. We explained that a heta iska does not guarantee a lender his capital. A heta iska only makes it likely that a lender will be repaid his capital. How does it make it likely? The lender, he stipulates with the borrower that if you're going to claim that there were losses or you're going to come and tell me how much profits are worth, you're going to have to verify it with Edim or with Ishvur. Until then, I don't believe you, and you have to repay me the capital and the profits. What would be if the lender knows firsthand that there were losses to the capital and there were no profits as well? Would he still be able to tell the borrower that I made a condition with you? You have to verify the capital, any loss of capital and the profits, and if not, you have to repay me? Or do you say no? The whole idea was a method of verification. Once it's clear the lender has first-hand knowledge that there were losses or there were no profits, then he shouldn't have any room. He shouldn't be able to ask for any verification. So the fascinating story brought down in Sefer HaTchumin. Sefer HaTchumin brings down a story which happened in the 1980s. It brings down, I think, 1982, where a lender knew firsthand that the borrower had suffered losses and that didn't make any profits. The story was that there was a man named Yitzchok. He went to a bank. The bank was called Bank Tzfon America. And he borrowed from the bank 1.2 million shekel. What did he do with the 1.2 million shekel? He bought shares. Where did he buy the shares? In Bank Tzfon America. In the same bank where he borrowed the money from, he didn't even take the money home. He asked the bank to transfer from one pocket to the other. He's withdrawing, he's taking a loan of 1.2 million shekel, and he's investing it, buying shares in the bank themselves. 6 months later, he received a letter from the bank that his shares have dropped in value, and they've gone down in value 120,000 shekel. And besides that, on his statement, it was clear from his statement that he was 1.2 million shekel in debt, and he also owed thousands of shekel interest for this loan. So 6 months later, 6 months after that, he sold his shares, made a loss of 120,000 shekel. He repaid what was asked. He didn't repay the entire loan, but he repaid up till the 120,000 shekel. And he told the bank. He decided that in desperation, he thought he'd take advantage of the hetesk. He told the bank, "Look, I borrowed this money to make an investment. The investment was not successful. How do I know it wasn't successful? You yourself told me that it was not successful. You made a dos, but then you admitted that the investment was not successful. You want me to verify? I don't need to verify it. So I have a proposal for you. There was 120,000 shekel loss. We're half-half, we're partners. I'm willing to pay the 60,000 my share, and you bear the loss of your share. And the interest payments, there were no profits, so interest payments are not paying any at all." So the bank, not surprisingly, weren't too excited about his proposal. And the owner, who was a Shem Teremitzas, he took him to Bezdin. He took this man, Yitzchak, he took him to Bezdin. So the bank had done the homework very well, and the bank came. Their tainas were, the arguments when they came to Bezdin were based on the Masham, which we mentioned earlier. Masham says that when a lender gives money to a borrower to invest, he becomes a partner in all the assets of the borrower. So the bank argued with this Yitzchak and said that even if you did suffer losses with this investment, but what happened to the other investments? How do we know that there were losses with other investments? And until you verify this, then you have to pay. The bank added that even if you are prepared to verify it, the bank had the condition between the bank and this gentleman Yitzchak was that the capital and the profits could be used, a method of shuwa could be used to verify. So he said that even if you're prepared to make a shuwa, we're not willing to accept any shuwa, even though normally you would be entitled to make a shuwa. But if you read carefully the rules and regulations of the bank, one of the rules and regulations is that if any time a borrower has a query or a question, well, he wants to argue on anything that he's received from the bank, he has 15 days to do so. And as long as he hasn't done so within 15 days, then it's considered as he's admitted that everything's in order. If he doesn't file a complaint within 15 days, then everything's in order. He didn't file a complaint within 15 days that there was a loss. So we take it as an admission that you've admitted that you made there were no losses and you made the profits which are necessary to repay us our loan. So there was a discussion. There was the Dayanim disagreed on different points. One point they all agreed on that this argument of Yitzchak that if it's clear to the lender that there were losses, then the borrower doesn't have to verify the losses, not with Edim and not with the Shavua. And this is extremely negative for us as well. Anytime a lender wants to use a heta iska, and it's clear that there have been losses, then the borrower will not have to verify the losses with Edim or with a Shavua. So this can be very negative in three different situations. They're all very similar, but because very negative, we'll discuss them a bit. Three situations are partners in a business, two is family members, and three is investments and syndicates. So we'll start with partners in a business. Partners in a business, often a business needs a loan. So how do they get a loan? So one way of getting a loan is from one of the partners. If a partner would want to take out a personal loan from a bank with interest, and he'd want to pass on that loan with the interest charge to the business, would he have a heter? So the Tassa says a tremendous chiddush, and Simon Kufayin says a tremendous chiddush, which is quite complex when it's mutter and when it's not mutter. So anybody who wants to rely on the Tassa would have to ask a shayla. The Tassa says a tremendous chiddush. He says that just like when a partner has an expense in the business, he wants to use a taxi, he wants to have any other expense. So it's considered a business expense, and the business is allowed to pay for the expense. So too, if a partner wants to take out a loan from a bank for the benefit of the business, so then the interest charges would also be considered a business expense. So if it's a business expense, then he's allowed, even though he's borrowing the money and he's fully liable to repay the loan to the bank, but because the loan was taken out to benefit the business, it could be considered a business expense. This tremendous chiddush of the Taz, there's an argument in the Chofetz Chaim, Shulchan Aruch, when exactly it could be used. What the Gefa asks is, what would be if the partners wouldn't want to rely on it, or wouldn't want to use a Taz, or the Taz wouldn't apply, and they want to use a Heta Iska? Or similarly, if a partner would not want to borrow money from a bank to lend to the business, but he's got his own personal funds. He's got his own personal funds, and he would want to lend to the business with charging interest. So here he wouldn't have the head of the Taz, because there is no expense on his money. His money belongs to him. And if he wants to pass on the money, he wants to lend the money to the business, charging interest, he'd have no head, he'd have to use a head to Iska. The shaila is, could he use a heti iska? The partners in a business, if they're both active in a, all active in the business, all actively involved in the business, and they know very well whether there were losses or there were profits, then they would have no heta to tell the other partners that until you verify losses and profits with a shuwa and with edim, you're going to have to repay me the capital and the profit. They know very well, they know quite clearly exactly how much profits were made and how much losses were made. So they would not be able to use the heta iska. What would they be able to do? They'd be able to use the eitzah that we mentioned earlier. That if the other partners have private investments, any other private investments or private assets, so they could use those as for the heta iska. They could be makna a share of those private investments, private existing investments, to the value that those partners are borrowing. And because the partner who's lending doesn't have first-hand knowledge regarding those investments, he'd be able to charge he'd be able to ask him to verify all losses and profits with the shuvah with edim, and until then he's allowed to demand that the borrowers repay the capital with their profits. Similarly, is a second common shaila is with family members. If a father, let's say, would want to buy a house for his son. So he'd want to buy a house for his son, but he'd be taking out the mortgage, and the son would be expected to repay the mortgage. So what's really happening here is that the father is, when he borrows from the bank, there are two independent loans taking place. One loan is from the bank to the father, and the second loan is from the father to the son. When the father pays for the house with the mortgage, he's paying for the son to own the house, and he expects the son to repay him. So if he's expecting the son to repay him, so there are two independent loans taking place, one from the bank to the father, and one from the father to the son. Now, for the father lending to the son is from a year to a year. So if he's lending him the principal, he's got no heta to demand that he pays the interest payments. So what heta would he have? So could he use a heta iska? So first, again, here, if we want to use a heta iska for houses, he'd have to make the calculations. Would the profits generated from a house, would they add up to the amount of profits that the father wants the son to pay as the interest payments? So if it would add up, in areas where houses are not so expensive, it would add up in areas where houses are very expensive, it might not add up. Everybody would have to make the calculations. So if the calculations all add up, so in times when house prices are rising, then it should be okay. If house prices are rising, the son would be able to pay profits to the son, to the son would be able to pay profits to the father, and be able to repay the loan with the interest payments. But if in times or in areas where it's clear that the amount of profit generated from the house is not the amount which the father is demanding the son to pay, for example, if the son buys a house worth £300,000, and the father's taken a mortgage of £300,000, and the interest payments would be, let's say, 5% a year, so interest payments would be £15,000 a year. So if the house prices stop rising, which like 10 years ago the house price didn't rise very much, if the house price in the area wouldn't be rising, and all there would be to include in the gain would be the rental payments. So if the father knows where the son is and he knows this clearly, then he wouldn't be able to demand the son to repay the full interest payments. He knows clearly that the amount of profit generated was not the amount that he's demanding, and he wouldn't be able to demand that the son pay the full amount. Oh, so could the father charge the son a rent? So if the father buys the house for himself, which means that if after 120 he passes on, the house would go to all the children equally, so then he could charge the son rent. But if usually what the case is, it's understood that the father's buying it for the son, and he wants the house to belong to the son, then he can't charge him any rent, the house doesn't belong to him. So all he's charging him is the interest payments, which he's lent the son money, and he's using that money to repay the bank.
Doesn't the son get a benefit?
What do you mean?
Because if the son will take out the loan himself, he'll get a high interest rate.
I hear. So according to the Sholem Meshiv, then maybe you could take that into account. You have to know that the Sholem Meshiv is controversial, but with the Sholem Meshiv, if he'd take out the loan, then he'd have to pay more than in Chanami. The third common shaila would be with investment from the syndicate. This is also this could be divided into three different categories. There are some have no ribbis issue at all. Some have a ribbis issue which could be resolved with the heta iska, And some have a rivers issue which can't be resolved without iska. So the way syndicates work, to the best of my knowledge, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the syndicate company, they search the market for good investment. If they find a good investment, then they inform the investors. The investors give them the money. The syndicate company now buys the investment for the investors, and they buy it on the syndicate company's name. Usually they buy in the syndicate company's name. So this is, and not only do they buy in the syndicate company's name, but they often write also a deed of trust that the investment belongs to the investors. So if there'd be no mortgage, everything would be straightforward. There's no loan taking place. The investors have given money to the syndicate company. The syndicate company have bought the property for the investors. Everything would be straightforward. But the problem can arise is when the syndicate company takes out a mortgage. So this can be very confusing. People normally think that you give money to invest, that's what needs a head to iska. That money doesn't need a head to iska. That money is investing money. That money is up to the risk of an investment. Anybody who's lost knows very well that this money is not guaranteed. The money comes back if the investment is successful, and if it's not successful, then it won't come back. What needs a head to iska is the other way around. When the syndicate company takes out a mortgage from the bank, so who are they taking out the mortgage for? They're taking it out to benefit the investors. Let's say the property costs £1 million. So they put down, they take the investors' money, 40% of the money. They take £400,000 from the investors, and they'll take out a mortgage from the bank for the remaining 60%, so £600,000, and they'll buy the property for the investors. So now, theoretically, what's happening is the same as with the father and the son. The syndicate company, two independent loans are taking place. One is from the bank to the syndicate company, and the second loan is from the syndicate company to the investors. So would the syndicate companies have a header for the investors to pay the interest payments? Usually what they use is the rent of the investment. The rent of the investment belongs to the investors. The investors have bought the property, so they should own the rent. And if the rent is going to be used to pay the interest payments, then that, without head to iska, should be a shaila of ribis. So now, could they write a head to iska? So we have the same problem. The syndicate company, who's managing the investment? The syndicate company are the ones managing the investment. So if they're going to use a head to iska, what are they saying? They're telling the investors, we're writing a head to iska, we're giving you money to invest, and until you verify the losses and the profits, we want you to pay. Why should they? They're the ones that need to verify the loss and the profits. They're the ones managing the investment. They know full well whether there were losses or profits. And if there were losses and profits, they should have no heter to use heter iska. So what could be done? So with a lot of syndicate companies, what they do is this completely avoids all river shiners. This is if a syndicate company opens a completely new limited company for each investment. Has to be for a new limited company for each investment. So if they open a new limited company, they buy the property, and they also take out a mortgage from the bank on the new limited company's name. So it needs two conditions. So firstly, the directors cannot sign any personal guarantee. And secondly, there can't be any other investments in this new limited company. So if they do that, so then who's liable to repay the loan? The person liable to repay the loan, he's considered the borrower. So although the syndicate company, when they apply for a loan from the bank, they're applying for it on their own name, but because there's no personal guarantee and there's no other investments in the limited company, so really what's happening is that the investors, the borrower's property, that's the only thing that's liable to repay the loan. If the syndicate company and the investors default on the loan, where's the bank going to go to reclaim the loan? They're going to go straight to the property. The property belongs to the investors. So really, who is the borrower? And according to Halacha, the borrower would be the investors. So if the investors are the borrowers, there's no problem whatsoever. The investors are borrowing from the bank, and they're allowed to pay interest payments on their own loan. So really what's happened is the syndicate company, they've brokered a loan between the bank and the investors, and that's no shine at all. That would avoid all river shines at all. The problem is only where new companies, where banks insist on a personal guarantee, then that would be a big problem. The syndicate company, the director would have to sign a personal guarantee. Once they sign personal guarantee, then they're already going into deep waters, because if they sign personal guarantee, either they become the borrower, or even if they don't become the borrower, then they become a guarantor. And the guarantor also has a ribbis shaylus. Can a yid guarantee a loan between another yid and a goy? If the loan is guaranteed by a yid, an orev kavlan, then he wouldn't have a heter to use a heter iska. Just one more restriction. Restriction is what would be setting a high school mispashus. Would there be any heter for a lender to set a high school mispashus? So we, as we spoke at earlier, the the interest rate of the lender is only equal to the amount that he's anticipating from this investment to generate. You can't ask for more than the amount that this investment is expected to generate. And with the Chatzim of the Chatzim Garden, you can only ask for half of the amount of profit that the investment is expected to generate. Would there ever be an opportunity for him to demand a high interest rate? So the only answer that there is if the borrower has any existing investments which generate a high profit, then if the borrower gives a share of that existing investment which generates a high profit to the lender, then the lender will be able to demand a high sum of specials, a high interest rate. But if not, then he will have no heta. So this standard can be very common with short-term loans. Short-term loans is often want a higher rate than usual. Chaim Yoch told us a shayla that he had a shayla in Australia. There was a person trying to buy a property worth $1 million, and just before the proposed closing date, there was a delay in the money coming in, and he didn't yet have the money. So he wanted to borrow $1 million from a friend, and the friend was willing to lend it to him at an interest of $10,000 for a week. So if you add up $10,000 for a week, it comes out to $520,000 a year. So that's over 50% interest rate. That over 50% interest rate is much too much, and it wouldn't be even a kulabikon investment wouldn't allow somebody to pay so high. The only time a borrower would be able to pay a high interest rate is if he's intending to invest the money and anticipates a high interest rate. Understand if somebody intends to buy a property and sell it very quickly, I think it's called to flip a property. Somebody's intending to buy it for cheap and sell it very shortly after for a very lot. That's when he's investing the money and then he'd be able to pay a high interest rate because he's anticipating a high return. But he has to bear in mind that if he's making the heta iska on a specific property which is generating a high interest rate, then he would not be able to give the lender a share in all his assets because they are not generating a high profit. He'd only be able to use this particular property and then he'd be able to pay him a high interest rate. Thank you.